Hope you will join us and settle in for some conversation. I'm Rhonda McBride. Welcome to Juneau Afternoon on this Friday. Coming up, the end of an exhibit at the Alaska State Museum, but perhaps the beginning of a renaissance in Chilkat weaving. Also, police and pastors in search of common ground as part of National Faith and Blue Weekend. And why tomorrow is a big day for bird lovers. Now our forecast. Expect rain tonight with lows around 40 degrees, winds out of the southeast, 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, widespread rain. Sunday, perhaps a break in the rain with some mostly cloudy skies mixed in with scattered rain. Juneau Afternoon. We'll be right back after National Native News. Gunashchish for joining us. You are listening to Juneau Afternoon. Well, my dad used to say to me when I was enjoying a trip to the park or something special, all good things must come to an end. And my heart kind of sank a bit. And such is the case for the Spirit Wraps Around You exhibit at the Alaska State Museum. I want to give you a heads up. Tomorrow will be your very last day to see it. And you'll be glad that we reminded you today. And joining us to do that, we have Steve Henriksen. He is curator of collections at the State Museum and Jackie Manning, curator of exhibitions, and a very special guest, Lonnie Hotch. She is one of the exhibit's curators, and she comes from one of the leading weaving families in Klukwan. She's a professional weaver, a teacher, and she heads the Chilkat Heritage Center there. Well, welcome very much to our program. I want to go around to each of you, Steve, Jackie, and Lonnie, starting with Steve. What are your emotions at this point, knowing that the exhibit is about to fold after all of your hard work?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a something that that people who work at museums get used to, the excitement of the new exhibits coming in and then having to take them apart and send them off. So you do kind of get used to it, but when an exhibit that's this special comes along, I think it's something that we all feel sorry, but on the other hand, in this particular case, most of the robes that we have on display, there's about 24 of them, and most of them come from right here in Juneau, Sitka, a few from Haines and Klukwan, and a number of others have been borrowed from local clans and owners. And so we, in some cases, we don't even have to really crate them up. They just kind of walk out the door with the owners. And I know that we'll see those again, probably at celebration or other ceremonies. There are a few special ones that we were able to get on loan from East Coast museums, and it was quite a chore to get them here because of the expenses involved. We had to do a lot of fundraising to be able to afford it. So I'm afraid it'll be probably not in our lifetimes that they're back here, but you never know. You can see some of them on display if you go to the East Coast, but those we'll have to say farewell to for now. And we're just extremely lucky to have gotten to see them in their birthplace.
Well, Jackie, it was quite a family reunion of weavers and blankets.
Absolutely. To have all these robes in one place. And I think one of the striking things about this exhibit for me is there's multiple times we have a lineage of teachers that are represented. We have Lonnie Hotch's great-great-grandmother's robe is in there, and a robe that Lonnie did, as well as another one that she worked on. And we have Clara Benson and Ginny Colanott, and another lineage there with Lily Hope locally and Ricky Tagaban, and Dolores Churchill and Evelyn Vanderhoop. So that to me is to have that, to see those teachers, you know, with the different robes that in that same space and that lineage of knowledge, that was pretty incredible. That's an incredible thing that we have there.
So, Jackie, I guess that space is going to be feeling pretty empty to you in a couple of days.
It is. The feeling that you have when you walk into that space with the robes, the hundreds of hours that goes into each one. I've had many people tell me that they feel the presence of the weavers when they're in that space, because so much time is spent on each of those robes. So you do, when you're in that gallery, you feel the presence of those weavers, and it's an incredible feeling. And I am not looking forward to taking those down. We have like Steve said, we turn around and need to return robes and prepare for the next exhibit. But this has been an incredible exhibit and once in a lifetime opportunity. If you haven't seen it yet, there's still one more day.
Well, Lonnie Hotch, you were there for the opening, and because you live in Clukwan, did you ever make it back to spend time with these robes?
No, I didn't. I wanted to, but then I had a super busy summer here in Clukwan, and just trying to stay on top of everything. And so I haven't made it back down there. And then, the COVID has really been a big outbreak, and that's keeping me from traveling too.
You know, it seemed like this exhibit, which was 30 years in the making, had a tough time because of COVID and all the challenges. But when you were there that day for the opening, and of course, you've got some direct connection to this collection, at least one of the exhibits, it must have felt a little bit like a family reunion to you.
Yeah. What Jackie was saying about how you can feel the presence of the weavers. And I know that firsthand, when I spend a lot of time weaving a piece, that, you know, I put my heart and soul into it as I'm weaving and weaving prayerfully. And I know with the thought that spirit is going to stay with the robe. And you know, we put those robes on people ceremonially for different reasons. And you want that to be a good spirit that you're putting into that robe, to bring healing, to bring joy, to bring comfort, all those things. As I'm weaving, those thoughts are in my mind, and I have to be careful that I approach it in the right spirit too, and we're always told this, not to weave on it when you're angry or depressed or, you know, not in a good frame of mind.
You know, we tend to think of things today as disposable. I mean, disposable diapers, disposable gloves, masks, but the thinking behind these robes and weavings was definitely not disposable. These were things that were going to last a lifetime and beyond.
Oh, yeah.
Was that part of your teaching, and how did that message come to you?
Well, I don't know if people really told me that, but it's very obvious when you grow up in the culture and you see these robes and they're brought out, you know, for different ceremonies, different events, you know, they go back generations. You just know that. You just figure that out just from the exposure, the cultural exposure.
So when did you get your start in weaving, and who lured you into the craft?
Well, my grandmother, Jenny Warren, her Tlingit name was Ka'ik. She wove, and my great-grandmother, Mary Willard, was a weaver. And my great-great-grandmother, who had passed on before I was born, she was a weaver too. And so I guess it's in my DNA. it's, you know, a part of my identity. I'm named after my great-great-grandmother. Her name was Santots, and she was the weaver of the sockeye robe.
So one of the robes, you think, was probably made by a relative because it has the same design that your family has had for a long time. I guess they show it at the exhibit. It's a wooden pattern board.
That's from my family. That's part of my collection. I inherited it from my grandmother and her mother before her. So those pattern boards, I have several of them that have been handed down through the family. And that one, Steve knew about it because he's helped us in Klukwan with documenting the different collections that are up here. And he helped document our families and our clan, the Kagwantan Wolf House here in Klukwan, our collection. And so he saw that copper's robe pattern board and asked to borrow it because he was planning on getting the copper's robe from the Peabody Museum. And so that's how that ended up.
So for those who don't know what coppers are, can you explain?
Well, they were used in trade and they were used symbolically in the culture. I remember attending Steve and Janice's wedding some years ago, and copper was presented there as part of the wedding ceremony. Yeah, they're somewhat like a shield, and they're made of copper, and they have designs on them, and they have a couple of folds in the metal to partition different design components.
What was it like to actually see that blanket in the museum, and just did you feel some kind of a powerful connection to it?
I was so excited to see it, and because I've seen pictures of it in books, you know, and I've seen it on the internet, but to see it in person was really a cool experience. And I saw some detail that's not real apparent in the photos, and like the little raven's tail lightning pattern in the corner. I was excited to see that because it was never apparent in the photos. So, but I would love to get to look at the back of it and see how the borders were joined. We have different options for doing joins in the weaving. And I know what technique my family like to use. And I wanted to see, you know, and it was different, you know, our technique was a little different from other weavers. And I just wanted to see, you know, if it really was one of my ancestors who did that.
It's too bad you can't be here for the closing of the exhibit. Maybe Steve Henriksen would let you get a peek at it as he packed it up. So, Steve, what's the story behind this particular robe? Where did we get it from, and how did they wind up with it, the museum back east?
It is, as museum objects go, it's one of the better documented robes, but we still don't really know that much about it. We know that sometime around 1829, 1830, a Yankee trader who was sailing on the northwest coast trading sea otter furs purchased that from Russians at Fort Ross in Northern California. And before that, we have no information on how it got to California, but it is a kind of robe that's only made on the northern northwest coast, and it had to have originated in the Russian colony, as they referred to it back in those days, or in what is now Southeast Alaska. And the fact that the pattern board, a very similar design, is from Klukwan, it gives us a clue that that's probably where that robe was woven originally. But how it connected with the Russians, we don't know, and probably never will know.
Oh my goodness. Such a story behind these robes, so many mysteries. So Jackie, can you tell us a little bit about how this collection was assembled? Because I guess the museum didn't make the decisions to pull this collection together on its own, did it?
You know, I think that's probably a better question for Lonnie and Steve, because they were part of selecting which robes came together. And I was part of helping get them on exhibit, but they were that curatorial team that made that selection. So I'll let them answer that one.
Yeah, we had a series of meetings, the curatorial team, and we worked on a storyline, and then we worked on selection of the robes. Steve sent us all a series of photos. We chose robes that kind of fit the storyline, how the weaving evolved over the years. And we wanted to show how that evolution took place, you know, from the cedar bark mats and then cedar weavings that looked more like, you know, like capes. And then they started including geometric patterns, and then started including wool. And then the wool were geometric patterns, and then started incorporating some form line designs, and then the full-blown old-style Chilcat robes that were broken up into three panels, and then the more natural figurative shapes of the robes, and then going back to raven's tail weaving. So kind of gone full circle now. You know, some people are weaving cedar bark robes again. So
let's hope that this exhibit sparks a renaissance and draws more weavers into making these treasures, so that it never ends. You know, the name of the exhibit, "The Spirit Wraps Around You." Lonnie, what do you think about that title? Was it the right title for this exhibit, and why?
Well, I think, Steve, you can answer where that name came from originally, but I do have some thoughts on that, but I'd like Steve to go first on that.
Okay, that's a rough translation of the Tsimshian term for these robes, and that is "the spirit wraps around you." So it's a description of the function of these robes in Tsimshian society, that it was something for healing, something used for healing, and the spirit power embodied in the robe, when someone wears it, it completely envelops them. And so the name suggests that these are not just works of art, although they are masterpieces. They are something about the spiritual side of life and something powerful medicine for healing purposes. And I really thought that concept was something we wanted to promote, because we wanted people to see beyond the beautiful artwork and see the spirit behind the art. And just recently I was in the gallery, and I met a local man who said he had seen the exhibit about a dozen times over the summer, and he was back for another look at it. And he said that he really thinks that the exhibit helped him survive the pandemic, because wow, because of the power. You can feel the power when you walk into the room. I've really rarely ever felt that in any museum exhibit, and it comes from that concentration of spirits that are in the room, the spirits of the weavers and of the ancestors who used those robes for so long. And that really, it's powerful. And we have a very special contemporary robe on loan from the Chilcat Indian village that they call the healing robe. It's a modern robe, but it's used for that very purpose. So it's really a perfect illustration of the title of the exhibit.
Lonnie?
Well, that healing robe that Steve is referring to, the impetus for that healing robe was not so much that you put that on and you'll feel this healing power. It had more to do with embracing our culture and the throwing off of the cultural oppression. Our people didn't feel free to practice our culture for many years. You know, there were laws against potlatches and children were punished for speaking the Thlinget language in schools. And we were encouraged to abandon, and even back in the territorial days, people had to renounce their culture in order to be considered civilized enough to vote. So all those things, I'm talking about the history of why we needed a healing robe. I took this class at the university there in Juneau, a seminar class on the Holocaust. And, you know, I learned a lot of horrific things that happened during the Holocaust, you know, genocide of the Jewish people. 6 million were killed during the Holocaust. And then I learned about the Holocaust museums that were going up and how the Jewish people were beginning to overcome that generational trauma through the creation of those museums. And that put a thought in me that we needed to do something like that to deal with the generational trauma that our people went through. And so that was the impetus that we needed this tangible thing, the healing robe, to literally put that on, embrace our culture, be proud of who we are as Native people, and throw off that cultural oppression. And there is healing in that. And we do use the healing robe, like during memorial ku'ichs, or even at funerals or the mortuary rituals that our people go through, like when somebody passes away and we gather in a clan house and we share their sorrow and offer words of comfort. Well, those robes will be brought out then too, our old robes. And I know, I remember putting the robe on a young person and telling him, you know, because the healing robe was woven by a group of us, and many hands had been on it, I told them that this robe represents all those weavers. It represents this community. And when we put this on, it's like a big warm hug from the whole community. You know, it's our love expressed in embracing you.
That is such a beautiful thought. So we are just about out of time. So, Steve, I'm going to let you wrap things up so we can, as a community, not miss this beautiful hug that's waiting for us at the Alaska State Museum. Give us the information we need to be able to see this one more time.
Okay, well, I'm happy to do that. We would really love to see folks come out tomorrow. We'll be open 10 to 4 on Saturday, and we can't have more than 20 people in the gallery at once. So if there's a lot of people, you might have to wait until things clear out a little bit. But you're welcome to come in 10 to 4, and from 2 to 4, I'll be in the gallery myself and just doing on-demand tours and just informal interpretation in the gallery if anybody wants to hear me, but you're welcome to come anytime, really. And that'll be your last opportunity. And after that, we'll start on Monday taking the robes down and starting the process of returning them to their owners. Also, I should mention that we were through the generous contribution from Janet Hall Schempf, published a catalog about the show that has photographs of everything and a lot of text and historical photos. That's on that's for sale in the museum and also on the Friends of the Museum's website.
All right. Well, we will watch for all those things. Gunnish Cheesh, Steve Henriksen, Jackie Manning from the Alaska State Museum, and Lonnie Hotch from Klukwan, one of the exhibition's curators. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So wonderful to hear from all of you.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
This is Juno Afternoon. Thank you for being here with us. I'm Rhonda McBride. This weekend is National Faith and Blue Weekend, where law enforcement agencies and ministries come together to talk about justice, to foster mutual respect in the community. Congregations across the nation are organizing events, and Juno is taking part in a live-streamed event this Sunday. Joining us now, Pastor Terry Stage Harvey and Lieutenant Jeremy Weske with the Juno Police Department. They've been working together to put together a forum on interfaith justice. This is the very first forum that you're planning.
Yeah.
What made you decide that it's time to do this?
Lieutenant Erickson reached out from Juno Police Department that they had gotten information about this. He knew I was married to a police officer and wanted to know if we were interested in participating and working together on this.
So tell me about being married to a police officer, being a pastor. You must have some interesting conversations.
We do. We actually have, and including our kids. And a lot of those conversations really do revolve around what does justice look like in a really messy world where people are complex and do some really horrible things to each other? My husband became a police officer later in life. So there are times that I appreciate that we had good grounding before the pretty horrible hours that police do tend to work. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Well, the focus on police departments across the country is pretty intense. Especially in the aftermath of George Floyd, there's been a call to defund police, require them to reinvent themselves. So, Lieutenant Weske, let me ask you where this forum fits into that.
Sure. At the Juno Police Department, our mission statement really revolves around partnering with the citizens of Juno. That includes partnering with groups who have stakes in this town, this city, where we have large groups of people who live here, and we look forward to these opportunities where we can interact, where we can get a feeling for where they're coming from, where they can get a feeling for where we're coming from. Those kinds of relationships are instrumental in getting through crises when they happen. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of stories from different departments around the country that came out right after the George Floyd incident. And one of the common denominators in communities that did well through that crisis was that the police department and different organizations in the community had open lines of communication with other groups. In the past, the chief is very open to meeting with different stakeholders in the community. And this is our chance to meet with the faith organization, something that we haven't formally done, I think, even though a lot of us have those connections anyways. This is the first formal event and we're really looking forward to it.
Well, better to have those connections, don't you think, before a crisis than during?
Yeah, absolutely. The communities that did well, that thrived, are ones that had those pre-existing relationships. We could just go right to one another, have frank, open conversations, and get any issues resolved quickly instead of having to start from square one.
So, Pastor Terry, do you think that this forum will build the kind of bridges that Lieutenant Weske is talking about?
I think beautiful things happen when people gather, and especially people who don't always know each other and understand each other's perspectives, and they have a chance to listen to each other. I know the police department often sees people on their worst day, and that is not the complete picture of who a person is. And so hearing from some of the faith communities where we get to see some of the same people with a wider lens and experience. I have an emergency room nurse who volunteers at our food pantry, and it was a great chance for her to see some of the same people who she's worked with before laughing and telling stories, and not on their worst day, but more of who they are as a complete person. And that changes. That changes the way that we relate to each other.
Well, Pastor Terry, you're in a unique position to know the kind of stresses that can make it very difficult for police officers to be the kind of person they want to be, because we all are never our best selves under stress. Your husband is a police officer. How does that give you insight to do this forum?
I think it not only gives me insight, but it really gives me motivation to do it. One, I realize that it is very stressful, and police do see things that are horrible that people do to each other, and it can become very painful, and it's hard sometimes to remember that people are more than that. But I want to support not only police doing their best work, but faith communities understanding that these are complex issues that folks are going into, that the police are going into. It's rarely an easy call, the use of force, or what do you do when someone is having a breakdown somewhere, and how do you intervene and keep everyone safe?
Well, Lieutenant Weske, you grew up in Juneau, and as a young man, didn't you intern in the Juneau Police Department?
I did, yes. One summer in my high school years, I interned at the Police Department, the Records Department.
So you have a long period of observing this police department and the changes, because may I ask how old you are now?
You can ask. It's going to hurt to say it, but I'm recently turned 40.
My goodness. So you've got more than 20 years of observing this police department. And what have you seen change over those years since you were a high school intern?
You know, when I worked at the police department, I really, even though I was there, I didn't have a good understanding of what life was like for a police officer. My cousin was an officer here. I was part of the Explorer program, so I did some ride-alongs, and maybe I got a little bit better view of it then. But even that, I don't think really prepares you. One thing that I notice is that the police department has always been staffed with people who are looking out for this community and other people's self-interest. You know, the style of policing may have changed. The way that we do things now is not the way we did things 20 years ago. But I know that the hearts of those people that worked 20 years ago, but we're in the same place that mine is now. And that's that we want to see the best for our community. We will do anything we can, form any bond we can, to try and continue that work.
But you must have different kinds of challenges than you had years ago that have to have new solutions.
I don't know if the problems are any different. There certainly is an increase in drug use. There's an increase in crime. Those are things that we can statistically prove are different. I think that mental health has always been an issue. It wasn't diagnosed. It wasn't talked about as much. And the same thing goes for mental health inside the police department. PTSD, things like that, those weren't talked about. And so we have a lot more tools. We have a lot more information. We're in the age of information now. And so we have a multitude of different ways that we attack these problems now that we didn't have back then. But I think the core of the issues that we saw then are the core of the issues that we see now. And that's kind of what Pastor Trey was talking about, that humanity and how we're able to see that in someone even on their worst day. So I think that still holds true now.
Well, you have to hold so much inside to be able to do your jobs, to keep your cool in very tense situations. So I imagine that a forum like this gives you a chance to let down your guard a bit and just soak in some other impressions about the community.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's nothing like being able to listen when stakes aren't high, you're not under a lot of stress, and you can gather a lot more information that way. And so getting to have these conversations when stress is low, we'll be able to have a great dialogue and get great insight into what our community thinks, what our faith community thinks about justice and about our police department. I'm looking forward to that.
Pastor Terry, how are you going to structure this?
So we have a wide range of presenters, and they each have been given 5 minutes to speak about what justice looks like in their faith tradition and in their cultural tradition, and then offer a prayer, a blessing, a scripture to kind of support that. And there will be a chance for questions, but mainly it really is a presentation of here's what we see justice, what a just community looks like. And so like Michelle Montz is speaking, she was involved with Black Awareness Association, has been part of a variety of different churches. We have someone from the Hispanic community and a missionary for Light of the World Church, the Baha'is, the Unitarian Universalists, the Jewish community, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Orthodox community, the Catholic and Alaska Native community. And that's not even fleshing all that out. But I think a wonderful mix of perspectives that I'm excited to hear, because I don't know what it's like to walk in someone else's shoes. And so I appreciate hearing that.
Well, that's an interesting concept that different faiths and different cultures indeed have perhaps a different concept of what justice is.
I mean, I think it's very true just from my own conversations with people of how we pursue justice in this world and what that looks like is very different and also has some great similarities. And so to highlight those as well as the differences, I think can make for very fertile ground for how we live in community together.
And I suppose if you don't understand the cultural approach to justice, there's a lot of room for misunderstandings in the heat of battle, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to understand how people prioritize their lives, and especially how they view a healthy and whole life and what they're striving for in that. I think that does help us interact with each other.
Well, can you give us maybe some tangible examples of the kinds of revelations that we might have as to how different cultures and faiths perceive justice or what lens they see it through?
I don't. I mean, I would not want to be presumptive about that. I can say, one of the things that I've learned, I lived over in Angoon eons ago, and one of the things that I have learned from my friends there is that relationships are a high priority. And so whatever, however much time it takes to be in relationship with people is okay. And that's really hard for me because I have a list of here's what I'm doing today. And so accomplishing things is a high priority for me. And so being able to bring that together and be like, oh, it makes sense how you can spend 4 hours hanging out together and just hanging out when there are things to be done because nurturing that relationship is a priority. I imagine some of the things about justice will come out too, of whether it's order or equality, or I just don't know what people will say.
So Lieutenant Weske, what observations do you have from being out in the field about how culture and race put things in a different lens for all the different people that are involved?
Everyone has different experiences in their life. Some of that is related to their culture. Some is related to their race. Some is related to interactions they've had in the past with law enforcement. One bad interaction can spoil a person's outlook for the rest of their life. And that goes for their interactions with police. And that goes for my interactions with my favorite sports teams. They screw up one time and their failures forever. So I think that's a very common thing. And in that is often lost the other side of the coin. And that's where we hope these conversations are helpful, is that we can each see where the other is coming from. Like Pastor Terry, I wouldn't want to presume what others might say or how they might feel. But I know that over the course of your life, there are a lot of different influences.
Let me frame it this way, Lieutenant Weske. Conversely, one bad experience can lead to a chain of bad experiences, but have you seen where one good cross-cultural experience has led to a chain of good things happening?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Maybe you could give us an example, maybe without being too specific. What are some circumstances where you've seen the right response to something create a good chain of events?
Yeah, I can tell you that personally, I have had on more occasions than I can count on my hands, someone come to me and see me in a store. I'm not even working, I'm not in uniform. And they come up and they say hello, and they tell me that they interacted with me in a police setting 5 years ago. And the interaction, while not their favorite thing at the time, it was a good experience in the fact that it put them on the right path. And they come back years later to say thank you. Every officer here has had that interaction where you get to see the fruit of a good interaction. I've now worked long enough where I can see kids who I maybe worked with when I was first starting are now adults, who have a good outlook on police because when we were there, maybe dealing with their parents, the interaction was positive enough that it shifted that mindset for them for the rest of their lives. So we do see that. I wouldn't give you someone specific example, but that is a common thing that happens. And the longer that you work here, the more of those stories that you hear. So I know that it's true that those relationships that we build bear fruit down the road.
What are you hoping to learn from this interfaith forum?
There are going to be a wide range of views on a lot of topics. And I just find it very interesting when we get to hear how someone views the world that may be different from ours, you know, something that we may maybe never thought of. And so I hope that in the course of that hour or hour and a half that I get to glean some insight into how other people view us. Because if I know that there's a perception, I can then work towards making that perception better, maybe, or maybe continue to foster that positive perception that they have. And so if you don't know, you never really know where you're going, but we just hope to learn as much as we can.
I also hope this is a springboard for the interfaith groups to continue or to pick up meeting again, because I do think when we trust each other and there is a crisis in town that we can respond appropriately, and having regular gatherings or chances to check in and listen are extremely important for a healthy community. And I know Jeremy has a pretty full schedule, and I appreciate the chance to talk together.
So just in wrapping things up, what is it that people can expect specifically, and how can they access your virtual forum?
So there is a link to join us on the webinar, which would allow people to ask questions through the chat, or they can watch it on Facebook. I believe the JPD Facebook page, it'll be recorded and available. I think it would be great to have people on the webinar so we kind of have a sense of who's there and what questions people have. And this is a neat thing about Zoom, is that we're able to gather and do this in a way that we might not have thought of before all of this. So excited to see everyone.
One of the things in our community is that we have a growing awareness of discrimination. We had the Orange Shirt Day, in which people came forward and talked about abuse that Indigenous children received when they were attending government-run schools, like the Mayflower School, which is now in a building that's occupied by the Juneau Montessori School. But many people in this community have never heard those stories. So it stands to reason that this community could stand to learn about what racism exists here. Where does the Juneau Police Department stand on this? The George Floyd murder has made police departments all over the country examine the way they deal with other races. Where is the Juneau Police Department in that process?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that question for you. I can tell you that race or racism has since I started, so 15 years ago, has always been an important, I don't know if topic's the right word. There was never a moment working here where someone from leadership came and said, okay, guys, well, it's time to start thinking about race now. That's just always been how we've operated since I've been here. We treat people the same, no matter who they are, no matter what their race, what their culture. We strive to treat everyone the same, provide everyone the same service, and get everybody what they need, what they deserve. And I mean that in a good way, what they deserve. We are always trying to improve. I know that our chief has taken steps, making great effort to reach out to the community, to be as involved as we can. When right after the George Floyd incident, we had a chance to just sit down and listen. The community was able to call in and just talk to us about how they felt about the police department and our dealings with race. And I think for the most part, that conversation was actually pretty positive. There were a few people who had some issues. And I can tell you that the chief immediately got a hold of me and made sure that I checked into any incident that somebody called and talked about where they felt like they were mistreated because of their race. It's absolutely something we do not stand for and would not stand for. And so I think we are very, very aware that it can exist, whether that's in a police department or outside of the police department. We take great pride in the fact that we do not treat people differently.
Do you think that a lot of times, because we don't know each other, we have different cultures, different ways of doing things, expressing emotions, that there are times when behaviors can be taken as racist or misunderstood? And do events like this forum help bridge those misunderstandings, prevent them?
I mean, that's the hope. You hope that anytime that you get to interact with somebody, you know, we talked about it earlier, if you know someone and you understand where they're coming from, what may have seemed racist or just rude or something like that may seem different to you if you know, one, the person, or two, the reason why they're needing you to do something. So yeah, these kinds of forums, whether it's race or religion or whatever it is, we know that humans, if they communicate, if we have open lines of communication, we know that we're able to work through things better.
Pastor Terry, do you want to weigh in on that?
I think the police department has actually been way more involved in addressing racism than most churches. I mean, churches are still some of the most segregated places in our nation. And so to think about, and not purposely, there's not like a sign there, but to think about how do we know each other and be in community together. So I'm excited. I mean, I think we do that by listening and having space where we can be ourselves and gather together and ask some hard questions and listen to some hard discussions without assumptions about who people are, but meeting them where they are and hearing that out. So I appreciate a lot of the work that JPD has done addressing some of that and their openness to this forum and having this experience. So, and I appreciate our time that's in your questions.
And thank you for answering all of our questions. Pastor Terry Stage Harvey and Lieutenant Jeremy Weske with the Juneau Police Department. And if you want to watch this forum, you can go to the Juneau Police Department Facebook page for a live stream of the event. That'll be Sunday, October 10th at 4:00 in the afternoon. And once again, thanks very much, Pastor Terry Stage Harvey and Lieutenant Jeremy Weske. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rhonda McBride. Why, tomorrow is a big day in the world of birders, known as October Big Day. And Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society is here to tell us how you can get involved. Now, I guess it involves counting birds, doesn't it, Brenda?
That's correct. We have to go out and look for them.
Well, I hope we get a break in the weather to go do that. But what's the purpose of this and how widespread is this?
Well, last year, over 32,000 birds were counted and 7,000 species. It's a worldwide event to try and look at birds all throughout their migration season. And so who's come back to Juneau, who's left? And it's something that citizen scientists can use to help understand how the birds are faring out there in the wilderness.
So do you expect a fairly big turnout tomorrow?
Well, the Juneau Audubon has done a little bit of a plea to have a little test. We'll see who can find the rarest, the best, or the most. And in our next newsletter, we'll let everybody in Southeast Alaska know. So we're hoping that Gustavus and Ketchikan, who always beat us, will not be playing this time.
All right. So how can we get involved in Big Day, the October Big Day? Do we have to go online and sign up, do anything like that?
Well, you know, the best way to get your data into the whole world's data set is to go to ebird.org. Or just look for eBird on your app. And there's a free app for Bird ID if you're not real sure of things called Merlin Bird ID. You can put on your phone or other small device. And it's just a way to help everybody put in the same kind of information in the same way. And they love having photos or recordings too. It's really important to make sure that what the bird we think we're seeing is the one that we're writing down.
So what have you been seeing out there lately? I know that rarely a week goes by that you aren't out and about.
Yes, indeed. This week it's been kind of fun because there's a coot, an American coot, hanging around the police station. They don't live here at all, but every once in a while, every couple of years, that we have one stop by in town. And there's a ruddy duck, too. And guess what? The short-eared owl's back. So there's all kinds of fun things to go out and see if you can find them.
And just in wrapping things up here, thank you so much for being with us all summer, giving us weekly updates on bird watching opportunities. But you do have a lecture series coming up. When does that start?
Our very first one is next Thursday, October 14th. We're going to talk about the Tree Swallow Project here in Juneau, 62 boxes, and how was our success in this lovely, chilly year.
Tree swallows. It'll be great to hear about those. I don't think people realize that the Audubon Society does research as well as look for birds.
Yep. Well, citizen science is very, very helpful in these days of low resources, money resources for researchers. So we're trying to do a little help to the state of Alaska and the national database.
And as far as tomorrow goes, the big day, so to speak, do you think that Juno is going to contribute to that worldwide database significantly?
Oh, I'm sure that we have a lot of good birders here, and they're really excited about all the rare birds. So if they'll just enter their eBird lists online, then we could probably beat everybody in Southeast because we've got lots of good birders here. And it starts, it's 24 hours. It goes from midnight to midnight.
So do you think, though, that we probably, as far as a community goes, have more birds than, say, a community down in the lower 48 to count?
You know, that's an interesting question because just going from here to Ketchikan, they have a lot more species available to them because it's not quite as chilly and they don't have as many glacial coolnesses around Ketchikan. So the farther south you go, there's places, of course, where the birds go for the entire winter, and there's millions. So it's different. We have lots of interesting species, but maybe not as many birds.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Brenda Wright with the Juneau Audubon Society, and we look forward to your winter lecture series. Thanks.